Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Well, hello, Judy, and hello, viewers and listeners. Our topic for today is
ethical non-monogamy, kink, and sex therapy. An interview with Jody Shea.
Yes, indeed. Jody is a sex therapist and couples therapist out in California. Mm-hmm. And we just finished that interview, and it's really interesting. And she's got a lot of interesting spins on how she does that work.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out. It's interesting. I put the title on, actually. I will disclose. I put the title on before we actually did it. We didn't talk much about kink, although it was mentioned in passing.
Right.
But we did talk quite a bit about ethical non-monogamy and sex therapy and some other stuff.
Yes, we did.
About that. So please stay tuned for that. Before we do that, let's advertise our fun stuff to advertise here.
Okay.
So what should we start with?
What do we usually start with? Your books.
My books.
Your
let's
books.
Start with my books.
Okay. Well, why don't we start with Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy, and How to Get It Back.
That is the book, as you so often point out, that started this podcast, basically.
That's correct.
About 3.5 years ago now.
Yeah, 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, because it came out on Leap Day,
yes,
2020, February 29th,
right.
2020. And it's still out there, and I think it's a darn good book.
Still
by
out
the way.
There, still selling, still doing well, and people are appreciating it. And
yes,
then we have the latest book, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
Is wrong, indeed. That one, we actually comment on that subtitle in the interview, so you can check that out. I'll mention a thing or two about that as well.
Right. And do we want to talk about the booklets?
Why not? Let's talk about the booklets, the more recent booklets.
Yes, there is My Husband Complains About My Cleaning. What Do I Do? Hint, it's not about the cleaning.
That's a book that happened because some people were asking about that. So that's available. If you've been wondering about that one, feel free. And
last but certainly not least, 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
Yes, indeed. Isn't that a nice looking paperback?
It is.
It's a nice looking paperback. It's got pictures in it. It's got really, I think, very good text in it. And you don't have to buy it.
You don't.
Now, isn't that something? Now, let me say, if you want that nice looking paperback, you have to buy it.
Yes.
It's available on Amazon.
Yes, you do.
But I am going to give you free a PDF, which is the same thing as that.
Yeah,
it's not in print, but it's a PDF.
No,
yes. All you have to do is sign up for my newsletter, Dr. Chalmers' newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And Judy, how can people sign up for my newsletter?
They can go to our website, ctin7.com.
Which, let's see if I point correctly, it's right about there when we get this. You'll notice
so
up
those
above
of you
my head.
Who are watching this will see it over our head. Those of you who are listening, go to ctin7. That's the numeral 7.
CT, like couples therapy,
exactly.
ctn7.com. And when you do that, a magic box will appear, which if you click on it, that will take you to a sign-up form for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter, which it's monthly. I've been doing it roughly now. And I just have fun with it, and I think you'll have fun with it too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worth checking out.
And we also want to put in a word for
our
merch.
So those of you watching are seeing what we're holding up, and those of you listening might just wonder, what is that
clinking
clink all about? It is clinking together our two
sound
beautiful
of our mugs.
Our mugs.
Not our faces.
Not our faces. Those are beautiful,
our
too.
Our beautiful ceramic mugs that have our gorgeous logo on one side, Couples Therapy in 7 Words, and our motto, Be Kind, Don't Panic, and Have Faith, on the other side, available in 11 ounces and 15 ounces, also available in t-shirts and beautiful sturdy tote bags.
And that is at our website, ctn7.com. You'll see there's a shop tab. Go there, and all that merchandise is available to you. So now let's put in a word from our sponsor. Judy, tell folks, who is our sponsor?
Our sponsor is The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Yes, indeed.
So if you would like a little bit help in the bedroom area, let's say, sometimes to spice up things in the bed, whether you're with a partner or by yourself or more than one partner, you can read this book either to yourself, to each other, out loud,
Or you can get the audiobook that you recorded, that Judy recorded.
And you can listen to it with each other. And it's an anthology of 10 short stories from the Bible, the Old Testament, and a lot of characters that you might be familiar with. And the stories come straight from the Bible, but it's filled in with lots of sexual details.
Yes.
Very erotic.
Explicit details. So if you are into that, this is a great book to have.
Mm-hmm.
So, on that note, let us go to our interview with the sex therapist.
Yes.
We'll do that, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Jody Shea. Jody is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California and owner of Pillow Talk Therapy. She specializes in couple relationship and sex therapy and often works with the LGBTQIA+, ethical, non-monogamy, and kink populations. She is also trained in internal family systems, IFS, which adds a deeper level to her work. Jody is passionate about all things relationships and believes in a world where our needs are not seen as wrong and we are given the tools to navigate relationships successfully. Jody, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Really excited. This is what I love to talk about.
Oh, good. We're glad to have you. So just to start off, could you tell us, how did you get into the work you do? And, you know, tell us something about your own journey that brought you to what you do.
Sure. Yeah. It has definitely been a journey. I will say that. I was following just the typical, had family that was like, you're going to go to college, even though many of them hadn't gone to college yet. So it was just, hey, you got to go do something. And I actually was going to be a pharmacist. And then I realized, a couple years in, I was like, that was really going to suck. So the money was nice, but the stress and other things that kind of came with that, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. So I switched over to psychology. In the world today, that doesn't really give you much. Mm-hmm. I traveled for a while, just kind of had my me time. And I had a friend reflect for me. And she's like, you put a lot of effort into like dating and things like that. I'm like, yeah, because I find it so important. And it's always been something I've wanted. And I was like, how could I talk about that all the time? Mm-hmm. And so I researched grad programs and got into a marriage and family program, knowing I wanted to do at least couples relationship work. And then the sex therapy part kind of found me afterwards. And I'm still kind of saddened by how many couples therapists don't know much about the sex therapy aspect of work.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely interlocked, right? And so that's been actually a really nice component, is we can kind of do both there and I get a mix of them all. So it's just, yeah, it just clicked one day and then we were off.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I will share one of my favorite stories. You've heard this one before. Uh-huh. About that issue of couples therapists not being familiar with sex therapy or even willing to talk about sex. It was roughly a year or so ago. I was at a training, a continuing education training for couples therapists. So there were, and it was on Zoom, there was like 100 and some people, in the Zoom meeting. And the trainer said, okay, how many of you routinely ask about couples sex lives in the first or second session? And I'm thinking, well, obviously, right? Because I ask about it almost always in the first session if they haven't brought it up. And it was about 30% of the people in the room. It was like 70% or so, something like that, didn't even ask about it and would say things like, oh no, I'll wait for them to bring it up. And I'm thinking, seriously? I mean, you wait for them to bring up questions about finances? You wait for them, it's amazing. So
yeah.
I get that. Yes, indeed.
And it was almost like a permission thing. I did notice that once I shifted to adding the sex therapy part, was I went from couples being like, oh my God, that's an awkward question, to this is what we're coming in for. Here you go. Uh-huh. Right in the top three. So it was, and they do talk about that in that training. It's about, really asking for permission. And I didn't even really barely need to do that. Just even saying I do it, they were like, we're ready to talk about that.
Right. Yeah. Isn't it interesting? I often find when I ask about it, it'll come up and it ends up seeming like, oh, that's really what they were thinking about, but they were a little worried about talking about it, which a lot of people are. And just, to offer that permission sort of opens the door.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What is ethical non-monogamy?
So that is it's an umbrella term. So it kind of includes, you know, what we would call polyamory and these other different relationship dynamics that basically include you may not just be with one partner. And it does also include whether that's going to be sexually and or romantically, because there are differences between that, right? A lot, there's a lot of different formats. So whenever I have people come in, I have to clarify what exactly are their agreements and their interests in how they want that to be structured. Some people want to know, some people don't want to know anything. It's completely separate. And so it's anything basically under those umbrellas. It used to be kind of consensual non-monogamy. I believe they've kind of shifted that more towards ethical non-monogamy.
Yeah, but that allows for the possibilities you were just saying. A couple could have an agreement where it isn't consensual in the sense that they don't want to know. So, you know, someone would be having sex with someone else without their partner's explicit consent because they have the overall sense that, no, you could do that and I don't want to know. So ethical is a wider term. You know, a few weeks ago, we interviewed Joe Court. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
Yeah, he was great to have on. And he pointed out something I think was fascinating, that we're kind of, you know, vanilla monogamous, you know, that's who we are. And I've often commented when I've heard about any sort of non-monogamy, be it ethical or not, of course, as I so often point out, I don't have a random sample of folks. People are consulting me because they're having problems. So when I tend to hear about it, it's not because, oh, that's working well. There've been some exceptions actually, but usually not. Usually it's because they're having issues around it. You know, it's something of a shit show going on. But what Joe pointed out, I thought was fascinating, was that even people who say they are monogamous need to negotiate what that actually means, because it's not always clear. Does that include things like not using pornography? Does that include things like not using sex workers? And he was talking about gay couples, gay male couples, who were saying, who would ask, are you monogamous? And they would say, well, yeah. Well, we do threesomes, you know, but that doesn't count. You know, they still consider themselves monogamous. So it's really interesting. And if you don't talk about it, you may not know, you know, exactly what it entails.
Yeah, you can never assume. You have to, and when I work with these clients, I really have to remind them that you can make a plan as much as you try to, but still there's no guarantees. Like, you're still going to step in something at some point, most likely. Yep. It's just impossible to plan that out.
Yeah. Yeah. That distinction, for example, between a sexual relationship and a romantic relationship can get awfully fuzzy for a lot of folks. You know, they may think, oh, it's just sex, and then come to discover they start developing romantic feelings, and then that gets kind of messed up.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So so when couples come to you with these ethical non-monogamy problems, can you talk about, like, give some examples of what that would be?
Yes. So I've had a few people who they have already started it and they're just running into some issues, whether that be jealousy or I've had some people where, you know, if it wasn't working out for one partner, then maybe, you know, the other, and it was for the other partner, then that would bring up some things because we all, you know, expect, oh, it's going to be great for both of us. Mm. Not always the case. Mm. I would also have it where sometimes they are already, or they're not practicing it already. And so they're kind of like, we really want to be mindful that this is a process and we know this is kind of potential for tricky waters here. Can you give us some guidance? And so we'll look into that. And I actually haven't had too many where more than two people came. I have had one recently, and that's been really interesting too. It's like just you're having the typical problems, but it's just, you now have another body in the room.
Are you talking about a throuple basically?
Yeah. Like throuple or plus, it's, you know, it's like the similar things that you'd have for anyone that's in a regular monogamous relationship, but it's still, okay, now we have to juggle a whole nother person, and that becomes very messy at times, especially if it's not separated.
Yeah.
So,
wow. Yeah,
that is interesting.
So it's a lot. It's beyond couples therapy, right?
Yes. Yeah. And especially in today's climate too, I've seen an increase also in the reasons people are exploring that. One, it's, you know, we love to shame ourselves and find a reason how we're not in the up-to-date relationship dynamic. And I've seen people kind of shame themselves. I should be able to do this. And we kind of have to help them understand that that's okay to not be perfect. And then I've had some people, they explore it because they're, you know, they're realizing that they're LGBTQIA plus and their partner is only one of those genders and mm-hmm. they want to explore more than one. And so that's not something they would have the opportunity to do otherwise. And so I've seen some things like that, that kind of have been a little bit new. I'm sure they've been around, but I've definitely seen an increase in that, both in my clients that practice consensual non-monogamy and the ones that don't.
Mm. Yeah, what I've noted is there's an increase in language for it. So people can name it and talk about it in ways, and then are invited to talk about it in ways that aren't just overly dominated by shame. So yeah. They can actually bring it up and then, you know, and try and work with it. You know, that phenomenon in terms of ethical non-monogamy, I have noted, again, a number over the years, I've noted this. Sometimes one of the partners is the one who wanted it, and the other partner only agreed to it because they worried that if they didn't agree to it, they would lose the other partner. And that itself tends not to work very well. Do you
yes. remember
that?
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. I've had a few you know, couples that have come in and they're like, oh, we've already, you know, decided we're doing this. And I've kind of heard some of the red flags in the session of that might be happening when one partner's just kind of submitting to because the other person's been really strong about it. Mm. And, you know, it's kind of hard as a therapist to decide, you know, how much do you kind of push with that? I try to be pretty honest and say, hey, I'm a little concerned, you know, or what would that be like if one of you wasn't okay? How would you know that this wasn't working for you? And, you know, sometimes they don't come back after that and sometimes they do, but you know, it's that whole thing, if we can't really work harder than they are. And, you know, that seems like a conversation that probably needed to be had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah. If it's a question they can't answer, it almost seems like it's bound to be a problem one way or another.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So how do you view the difference between sex therapy and couples therapy?
So I would say they're pretty intertwined. And that's what's always interesting when I get sex therapy clients is they don't always realize how related to other things it is.
Yeah.
I've had people who've been in relationships and been having all these symptoms and they're like, you just disclosed years and years of sexual and emotional trauma. And I'm going to say that's related. They're like, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so they don't always understand. Sometimes it's hard because it's harder to get buy-in. I always kind of joke that, you know, doing couples and sex therapy, I'm like, I chose the worst business model ever since they sometimes don't have the best attendance track record. Couples, you know, they just don't tend to stay as long most of the time as like a lot of individual clients. But usually when I'm working with couples, it's, you know, you're talking about a lot of, you're giving them a lot of tools and, you know, you're working a lot on the communication aspects, which is, you know, of course, for most of my couples, that's the biggest thing. And some get it kind of quickly. Most don't. Mm-hmm. It takes a really long time to not talk over each other and, you know, just be able to regulate your own emotions when the other person's talking and it doesn't line up with your perception or, you know, trigger some of your own things. And then the sex therapy part is a little bit more pointed. It does include also a lot of psychoeducation. A lot of people, you have to kind of relearn what sex actually is and should entail. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are still kind of caught up in a sexual act includes penetration that results in an orgasm.
Yeah.
And that really kind of, you know, messes us up because there's this expectation and people get in their heads about it. And when it's not happening, they're like, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. And then even things that took a medical perspective, it just takes on legs of its own at that point. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit more direct. I'll have people with, you know, pain disorders, a lot of desire issue, some that are like, you know, out of control sexual behavior, which is like the, you know, updated term for sex addictions, just to destigmatize a little bit those terms. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit more focused, but oftentimes we will have to go into those other things, right? It might be a little bit more likely that maybe their partner isn't really ready to join, or you know, you don't have full buy-in with the sex therapy sometimes, or sometimes the client just doesn't want their partner included right now. You know, it's not safe. Mm-hmm. You know, you do get that sometimes with people that want to work on their relationship, but I feel like most of the time, you know, there's already kind of, they're both reaching out to you. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah, I rarely see when it comes up, when the issue of sex comes up, which again I ask about if they haven't brought it up. It's pretty rare that one partner will want to talk about it and the other won't. It is very common that they might be uncomfortable about it, but I can't think of folks where one of them would be saying, "Oh, I don't want to go there." You know, it's much more about, yeah, it's kind of scary to talk about, but yeah, I see why we should. You know. Usually there, but again, I rarely work anymore with individuals. Mostly I would just see couples. Yeah. We, a person we've interviewed, a couple of years ago now, it's been, Batsheva Marcus. Do you know that name? She wrote a book called Sex Points. She's a sex therapist herself. And, she wrote a book called Sex Points. And she, one of the things that I've commented, with Batsheva was that she has a chapter in the book, which when I read it, I said, and then we were interviewing her, and I said to Batsheva, "Hey, I really like the chapter where you warn people against people like me." And I thought that was really kind of cool, because and she demurred and she said, no, but yeah, that's kind of what she was doing. And it made sense to me, because she at the time she was working as the clinical director at a women's health clinic and working with physicians. And she's pointing out, it's not, I mean, yes, there's always relational aspects, but some of the stuff that people come to, and you mentioned, you know, like women presenting with pain or vaginismus or something like that. She was saying, yeah, there's relational issues often, but often the relational issues are caused by this, by the sexual issue, which is medical often. It's like, you know, if you consult your physician, and of course, that's another one. Not all physicians are trained well in sexual issues, but if you actually find a physician who knows about sex, you might discover they can give you some stuff that'll help. She said, you know, it's often as simple as dilators for dealing with issues, and you know, and various kind of hormonal treatments and things of that sort. And I always like that, because, you know, my training and my experiences in couples work, and you know, you're a couples therapist and sex therapist, and so I'm thinking it's always relationship. You know, it's like, oh, we have to investigate, you know, what's happening in your relationship that is being expressed, you know, through these sexual issues. And it's not always
the relationship. Sometimes it is physical.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's complicated, because the physical issues they may be having then spills over into relationship issues.
Right, it feeds off each other.
So. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. You definitely, and that's what they train us in when you do the sex therapy, is you have like these kind of tick marks of things that you have to assess for, and medical is number one, because if there is a medical issue, you're just fighting an uphill battle. I always find that, you know, usually like the relationship therapy and the sex therapy part is helpful, because, you know, I've had a lot of clients where it is a medical issue, but then it's these hurdles of still talking about it, understanding each other's experiences, and actually following through with those treatments. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of clients who know they need to be on hormones or need to use their dilators or do whatever, and they just aren't doing it, you know, or you have the other issue with our medical, you know, system where you can't get in for months and it just, you know, and you also have to wait for the medications to work. So, or somewhere it's just not going to be something, like I've had clients where they've had some form of cancer, you know, and yeah, they're not going to want to be touched. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do you do with that when you still have another partner that has those needs and these other things? So the medical part is so important. And at the same time, I've seen it almost like take less of a role oftentimes, because it's so much more of what's keeping us from following through on that. And like, you know, like I know with clients with dilators, like they're uncomfortable, right? And as soon as our body experiences pain, as soon as we experience pain, we're like, nope, don't want to do that again. Not on the top of my priority list. And it's also, and then it starts to get into, you know, maybe I'm comfortable with that, but it might be kind of a, you know, a finger to my partner at times when I'm okay with that not happening for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you said, that's when it starts to get into, you know, muddier territory to talk about.
Yeah, it does tends all to get mixed up. Yeah, the thing about medical issues often is when people can discover that, then sometimes what the effect is, they start taking it not so personally. You know, like the partner says, oh, okay, this, you know, I don't have to take this.
That explains it.
I don't have to, you don't have to feel like it's a personal rejection or something like that. And then, you know, you can expand the definition of what sexual activity is for folks, which is pointed out. So often people think it means penetrative sex, which of course it doesn't always mean that. And, you know, then they can maybe get someplace. You know, you mentioned IFS, internal family systems. I have a little bit of training in that as well. And, I've always found it fascinating. Could you tell us, you know, introduce our listeners to what that's about and tell us how you use it in your work?
Yeah, so it's a therapy model that has been around for a while. And I believe, you know, they say it's been, you know, kind of taken parts of it from, you know, past models, you know, from the greats, right? And so it basically is still systems theory, which is how we're interconnected. It's just more of the internal system, right? And I always love, you know, kind of asking my clients if they've seen the Inside Out movie from Pixar, because I felt like it was such a good explanation or intro to it.
My comments when we watched that together, and they just nailed the psychology in that movie. I love that movie.
Right. I just tell them that it's not so much that they're direct emotions and that they can literally be anything, because basically our parts are like little people, which some people either like, I have little people in my head, you know, and they're like, do I have schizophrenia? Right. And it's like, no, this is a normal human experience, you know? And I've actually, you know, back when I was, you know, pre-licensed, I would actually, I remember I got into an argument with the psychiatrist about that, because I had a client who would be like, I'm having, you know, I'm kind of hearing voices, or I'm like talking with myself. And I'm like, well, let's see how much of a problem that is. Like what, I'm not negating the fact that, you know, some people have that diagnosis, but it's also, you know, the way that psychiatrist was saying to treat it was just don't acknowledge them. Like,
oh my God.
I was like, but this is real for the client. And once that model got introduced, it just opened up this door of like them enjoying coming to therapy, and would come in with a whole journal of all the parts. And so, yeah, it's like these little personalities that you have that, you know, take on roles for you. You know, they're always there, but, you know, you go through a trauma, you go through your family dynamics, all these other things. And, you know, sometimes you'll take on parts from your parents, right? You have that one that's like, hey, you should be doing something right now, right? Or remember, you know, to make smart choices and, you know, things like that. And then you have ones that are trying to help you, but maybe aren't doing it the best way, but that's all they know. Right.
But one of the things I love about IFS is that all of the various parts that you interact with, you accord them legitimacy. You know, they're there for good reason. And I so love that way of working with people, to recognize that everything that's going on, even the stuff that's problematic in various ways, is there. You know, there's something valid about it. You know, we're all valid people. And it's interesting, you were describing that the phenomenon of, you know, talking to a psychiatrist about someone who's hearing voices. And of course, indeed, hearing voices could be some kind of psychosis. And I remember, you know, the name Michael White, he died a number of years ago, but narrative therapy guy. I did a bunch of trainings with him over the years, and died way too young. I think he was like 60 or something like that when he died. Anyway, he would describe when he would work with folks who had that particular diagnosis, they were hearing voices, it was clearly, you know, psychosis happening. And he wouldn't so much ask, you know, he wouldn't assume that they're bad. He would want to know what they were saying. And often they were saying terrible things. So he wouldn't talk about dealing with voices. He would talk about dealing with the nasty voices. And, you know, you had to find ways of working with the nasty voices. They were there for reasons, but they could be really nasty. IFS is fascinating because you don't have to be psychotic. You know, what Dick Schwartz talks about is it's everybody. We all have this. Yeah.
So to be clear, because I'm not a therapist, I'm the layperson in this room. So we're not talking about DID or schizophrenia.
No, are we? Which are two very different things also.
Right. But voices in our head, that's like your little Jiminy Cricket conscience that we're talking about right now. Okay.
Well, yeah, but the DID, I've also done a fair amount of work with people with DID, dissociative identity disorder for our listeners, which also known as multiple personalities. And what's fascinating about the way IFS is similar to working with someone with DID. The distinctive thing about folks with DID is the first D, it's dissociative. Uh-huh. In other words, they have parts of themselves that don't know about other parts, which can be very chaotic. And they so often you're talking to somebody who doesn't know what happened to several hours and doesn't realize that's not normal.
Okay. Whereas, so I'm trying to distinguish between that, something like that.
Yeah.
And like the voices in your head that are telling you don't eat that piece of chocolate.
Well, right. And it's what's interesting about IFS, it's not always voices in your head, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's parts of yourself you can learn to then invite that voice to speak. So you can interview those parts of yourself. And I remember one of my favorite questions that I remember learning from in a training with Dick Schwartz was that the question, when you're asking one of these parts of yourself, gee, how old do you think I am? I love that question.
Yep.
Because I found this part of myself that was thinking, it was a young part of myself, and it was thinking, oh, you must be about 20. And at the time I was doing this, I was about 60, And it was interesting because it really felt like that's what that part was feeling. You know, you can engage in conversations with folks that are, it opens up parts of yourself you don't realize are there, but they're actually significant. I'm curious, Jody, how do you employ it in your work, when you're working with folks?
So I just start to kind of introduce the language, because one of the benefits of it too, it helps them to externalize things a little bit, which helps with emotion regulation. And then as you can imagine with couples too, if I'm saying that there's a part of me that feels that way, but it's not all of me, it helps to de-escalate that conflict a little bit at least. Yeah. And so that's kind of where I start, is just introducing the language. And then I have some clients that kind of come to me directly for IFS or want to be or have more experience with it, so kind of want to use it more. And then I have other clients where it's like, ooh, that's really, that's kind of intensive. And, not everybody, meshes with that, mm-hmm. especially if I have clients that are kind of neurodivergent, they tend to have a harder time with more abstract concepts. And so I have some that have said, hey, that doesn't really work for me. And then others where it's like, they've done it, but it's just, they adjusted it a little bit in a way that fits how their mind works. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, I kind of add it in there. I don't always do full-on sessions, like intensive sessions, because they can be quite intense for people. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you go into like meditative state, usually like eyes closed. You don't have to, but like that's, usually the best way, because you're trying to visualize your parts and things and talk with them too. And so there's a wide range of ways that I employ it, but it's just helping them to understand things. And it actually is nice because it fits really well with the sex therapy part, because we do have parts that often, basically all of them have some physical component. And that's what we're teaching people, is how to notice it in their body before it's full blown triggered.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. Jill Bolte Taylor's work. She's the one, my stroke of insight. I recommend it to folks all the time. I've talked to a lot of clients about it. She's written two books. She's a neuroscientist who had a stroke in her 30s, which is very young to have a stroke.
Yeah.
And she's who better than a neuroscientist to have a stroke? And then when she got her language back, which took her years, she was then able to write about it very intelligently, because she knows all about the brain. So she wrote her first book and a TED Talk, which I recommend everybody hearing this. Go see Jill Bolte Taylor's TED Talk. It's called My Stroke of Insight. Just really kind of mind-blowing, and I think I mean that as a double entendre anyway. But her second book, which many years later, just a couple of two, 3 years ago, she came out with another book, which is called Whole Brain Living. And her thesis in that book is, we are all fundamentally four different people. And she actually has a section in the book where she maps her ideas onto IFS, actually, internal family systems, just to say that there's some similarities there. But we're, and she's very whimsical in how she writes about it, but we're four different people based on four different brain structures, left and right hemisphere respectively, and then midbrain and neocortex respectively. So that results in four different segments. And it's just very funny. Remember when I was reading about it, I asked you what you would call your four. She says you should name your four people. So I asked Judy, and you remember what you said?
John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
Of course, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. And it's fine, because you hadn't read the book. But
no, I hadn't read the book.
The funny thing is, there's some truth in that. There's some truth in why the Beatles are so amazing, because they do sort of represent those four types in some ways. And the fact of just recognizing that we're all multiple people, and I agree with you in terms of couples therapy, it can just take the edge off a lot. It's like, oh, yeah, I get pissed off, but I also, you know, I love you and hate you at the same time. Isn't that fascinating? You know, or I'm really angry, but I totally understand you at the same time. You know, that's I think a very useful skill for folks to develop.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's totally a very useful skill to have. I mean, we are very much in like the mindfulness stages right now of like, how can I reconnect to my body, right? Mm. And how can I learn more about myself and be more in tune with what's happening and get ahead of things? And that's basically a lot of what this is about and helping us to heal from the past.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of a trauma work, it's a way, you use that as a way of helping people sort of, you know, process trauma?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, for the trauma work, a lot of it is about the idea behind trauma is that we're kind of getting stuck in the past, right? And so that past basically means that we have a part that got stuck there and we do this retrieval process, right? And kind of like what you were saying, where there's parts that see us as different ages than we actually are, with parts that need that retrieval, that's usually what's happening. Is, you know, you talk to them and say, how old are you? And it's like, oh, this is kind of like a young part or a teenage part. And this is what they do for me. And, you know, they don't feel like they can do things for themselves. There's a lot of rules and whatever. And then and they say, well, you're not really there anymore. How old does it think that you are? And you're like, well, I'm in my 40s. And it's like, okay, that's not matching up, huh? You know, it thought you were still that age. And so you actually go through that process and you help them to understand. And you're just planting seeds. It's just like working with a full person in therapy. You're just kind of doing it for yourself, or I'm helping them to do it for themselves, where, you know, you're just planting seeds. It's very rare that a part, I mean, it does happen where, you know, you help them realize, hey, there's something that's not fitting here. And they're like, what? I don't have to do this anymore. Hallelujah. I'm out. Goodbye. <Yeah. laughs> See you later. I'm going to the beach. But most of the time, you know, they're a little bit more hesitant. They're like, I don't know what that would even look like to not do this, or I'm not feeling safe. I feel like you still need this right now. Mm-hmm. I don't fully trust you. And so, you know, we kind of just plant those seeds and help them to, you know, understand what's going on. And a lot of them often, when you are able to fully connect with them, are open to these things, and they're not as scary. As you know, we have these things called protectors, which basically we build like a layer, like an onion layer of all the different levels. And, you know, if you talk to your protectors about some of your core wounds and the exiles that are down there, like it is horrendous. It's a monster. It's going to cause havoc. Mm-hmm. And then you get down there and it's like this little, you know, meek, you know, weak little, you know, creature that's like in a room, like in the corner, huddled up in a ball. And you're like, oh, interesting. But it's often because those things are really hard to sit with. Mm-hmm. And those protectors are not much better sometimes. I mean, most of us, we know our critical voice is one people usually have a lot of access to. Our critical voice is like, oh, I want you to do better. And I want you to remember what had happened in the past. But I'm going to do that by telling you that you're garbage, reminding you of every mistake that you've ever made. No one likes you. And it's like, that works. Does that work? And they don't realize that.
Yeah. I often have noted that, you know, with folks dealing with trauma, that the idea of internalizing the bad is, especially like for young children, the alternative is worse. It's not like people are consciously calculating this as little kids, but the alternative is worse, because to feel like, okay, I'm being abused and shouldn't be being abused, implies, well, the world is completely out of my control and it's just pure terror. I'd rather feel like, oh no, I'm being abused because I'm bad, at least in theory, then I have something I can do about that. Right. And it's difficult to get past that as an adult, unless you're able to be in a safe enough place that you can actually, you know, wonder about that assumption. And, you know, that's what therapy is all about when it works.
Yeah, some parts are not gonna be able to be released or do a different job because, you know, like family dynamics are like such a good example, right? When we go around our family, we kind of revert a little bit, right? And we've developed coping skills and protectors that need to be there because we're kind of in a space where we can't really control that environment all the time. You know, there's only so many times you can tell somebody, hey, that really hurt my feelings, or I really don't like that dynamic we have. And it, you can't control whether they change that or not. So you still may need those things. Mm-hmm. It may be able to relax in other areas of your life, but it's kind of rare that they don't need to do that job at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's often about some more adult parts being able to be reassuring. And as I've often point out to folks, you know, when you have in your internal conversation, when you have like an angry teenager or something like that, or an angry little child or a scared little child or something, it's like any other family. You're not going to banish them from the family. You're not going to let them run the meeting either, but you're going to take care of them. And it's often about learning as adults how to take care of those young parts of ourselves.
Yeah. And it is interesting too. I have had a few clients where, you know, they've had parts, because it's very rare that a part is kind of all on its own. There's usually, you know, part of what you do is you help, like, there's this one, and then you have to understand which ones are connected to it. If this one starts acting out, this one's going to come in and shut it down and, you know, pull me out of this experience. But I've had people that actually have formed like a little committee, you know, and we're kind of like, you know, you just imagine all the chairs and you're all kind of, they all have their ability to talk and, you know, about the issue and how they see what the solution might be and why they see that's important. And it's been really interesting and it's quite an entertaining model. Like, I kind of joke with people. I'm like, you don't ever need to do any psychedelics. You can just, you know, just do some IFS and you'll be seeing all kinds of things.
Yeah. It is interesting. You know, folks with DID that will often use a similar strategy. They'll actually get a committee together. They kind of have to learn about each other.
Yeah.
It's often much more dire in those situations because of a lot of genuine damage that one or more of the parts may have been doing, but it's a similar process. What else should we be asking you about, or what else would you like to be talking about?
Oh, that's a
it's a general question.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, in general, like one of the things I'm super passionate about, and I hear about it so much around now, which is awesome, is I just love attachment work. I just love it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there are some people that don't, but I mean, who doesn't?
And for those of us that are not in the field, talking about attachment work.
Yeah, of course. So basically, attachment theory is that kind of cliche thing of like you marry your parents kind of, you know, idea. And it's basically just about, you know, that there's a lot of merit to, how do we learn how to connect with people? You know, we learn in the first few years of life. It of course develops, you know, and becomes a little bit more complicated as we get older, but you learn how to connect with people through your caregivers. And for most people, that's their parents, right? Sometimes you'll have some external family members, grandparents, things like that as well. But they'll usually have a similar pattern unless they kind of do the whole thing where it's like, you're different with your, you know, your grandkids than you would be with your, you know, your first generation kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically those wounds that you've had. So usually it's the parent that you, you know, had some kind of issue with, had some kind of wound there, is usually the traits that maybe your future romantic partner will have. And I tell people that, you know, this is one of the things I just cannot shake because I just see it all day long. And what's so frustrating about attachment work too, is that it's, even though we tend to be in one category most of the time, it'll switch. As soon as things change, things tend to switch, right? So there's a couple different types. You have secure. Basically secure just means, you know, I can give and receive love pretty evenly, right? I can spend time with somebody. It's not going to trigger anything where I'm like, oh, you're kind of, you know, smothering me. Ugh. Or if my partner, you know, wants to spend time away from me for the day, I'm not like, you don't love me anymore. And I need to be with you all the time. And, you know, there's also ones that people that kind of waver between the two. So the people that tend to feel a little bit more smothered, we usually call them,
avoidant.
Blanking. Thank you.
Avoidant.
I'm like, why am I blanking on that?
I was thinking basically you've got secure, avoidant, and anxious, I think, are the three.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are mostly the three I use. I do acknowledge the disorganized, but I don't, you know, usually go into it too much just because it starts to get a little confusing for people. I try not to give them too many different options, but I'm basically like, even if you're secure, you still could, you know, go on the side of anxious or avoidant. It's just, which one are you a little bit more likely to have? Like if you're taking an educated guess, do you tend to need a little bit more space, or does space make you freak out a little bit? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you see this in relationships all the time. There's usually one partner that's on one side and one partner's on the other side. And it is just such a contributor to a lot of the conflicts that they have, right? Whether they're having trouble committing to the relationship, or sometimes because they have some of those things, they go outside of the relationship, or how much time are we spending together? I feel like I should be able to talk to you about anything. I don't want to have to talk to my friends about things. And, you know, I just see those things come up nonstop. And again, it's something that's like a lifelong journey of healing that people need to engage on to kind of heal that. That's something I've thought about so much, is how do you fix this? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you get through this? And, you know, there's books out there like Attached, and which Attached is good. The main thing I didn't like about it was it kind of took a anti-anxious avoidant relationship stance. It's like, well, you should really try to avoid that. But I guess if you're in it, we can figure something out. And like, I don't know. I tell people, you know, when you read the Attached book, they say, I think it was maybe like even 70%, or it was some like pretty high number that they said of people in the world that are secure. And I'm,
the numbers I've heard are a lot less than that. But of course, it depends
on how ridiculous
you define it. You know,
yeah.
What I've found about the attachment literature is it's like, well, I say the same thing about my own favorite theories, you know, mm-hmm. they're great as far as they go, but don't take them too seriously, you know, or don't take them too literally. Don't take them too, the subtitle of my most recent book is Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong. And I apply it to myself as well in the book. I say, by the way, that applies to me too. It. Everything I know about couples therapy is wrong too. Now, what is that supposed to mean? Well, it means very much things like, you know, attachment disorder is useful. IFS is useful. All of these things, all of these various, you know, systems are useful, but don't think they tell you the whole story, because reality is actually richer than any one description of it. That's that's like a tenet of narrative therapy, which also don't take too seriously. You know? So it is, but I do find attachment theory is often helpful for folks sort of understanding, no wonder this stuff freaks me out rather than that stuff. You know, that's a useful insight often.
Yeah. And I don't usually have commitment issues, but I will say when people always ask me, well, what kind of therapist are you? What are your models? And it feels like you kind of had to choose some. I'm like, I like a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the folks who are the ones teaching particular systems, of course, look askance at those of us who say, well, I'm kind of eclectic. It's like, oh, then you don't have anything. It's like, no, that's not true either. I think it's important to have some theoretical understandings, plural, to guide us, because otherwise we're just kind of shooting from the hip and not realizing we're doing that. And we got to be careful with that too. But no, of course, that.
And also people respond differently to different types of therapy as well. You know, you might find somebody that's like all about attachment or all about IFS, but then somebody will say, no, I really want to do the psychoanalysis stuff. And I really want to get to the core of this. And I really need rules. Like, how are we going to be able to sit down and talk to each other? You have to say, you know, with the, like, I know we've talked about with the I statements before, and that doesn't work for a lot of people, but for some people, they just need that discipline. So
Yeah, exactly. And look, there are some folks where I'm not the right person to work with, not because there's anything wrong with them or me,
right?
But sometimes go to someone who really likes working.
Just don't. And they want somebody that's going to work in a different way.
Yeah. Folks who are looking for like specific homework and tell us what to do, I'm the wrong one to talk to. I'll talk to them about that, but I'm not, I just have this sort of internal aversion to wanting to suggest to other people how they should live their lives.
I don't have to go home and journal.
And it's great if they do, but you know, I tend not to be that directive about things like that. Well, Jody, thank you so much for doing this.
It's really no problem
talking to you. How can folks get in touch with you, or you know, let people know, like, what if they want to get in touch with you, what should they do?
Sure. So my website is pillowtalktherapy.com. And I'm also on Facebook, kind of, and then I'm on Instagram as well. Still trying to be good about, you know, of course, therapists aren't perfect, but still working on kind of being consistent with my social media thing, but it's also Pillow Talk Therapy. You can find that on Instagram as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I'm around. I'm in, you know, if any, for any people that are, you know, in the Orange County, California area, you know, I get around a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, a lot of therapist communities, but I like to kind of be out and about, even though I just do online work. Uh-huh. It's just been really great to kind of connect with people and keep building all of these things. So I'm always open for other clinicians or things to reach out and clients, see how I can help them out.
Well, great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
So we hope you enjoyed that interview with Jody Shea. A lot of interesting things to say. So pillowtalktherapy.com is the place to find Jody.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting back to us.
Getting back to us. We always like getting back to us.
Again, if you would like to order any of the books that we talked about earlier or any of the merch, you can go to ctn7.com, our website. You can suggest topics for us to talk about on our show. You can even suggest yourself as a guest on our show.
And there's even a place there to sign up for a time to be on our show. Mm-hmm. We usually record on Fridays. We sometimes will, you know, make accommodations for folks if that doesn't work for you. So get in touch. Let us know. It's almost always been the case that if people have gotten in touch with us and mm-hmm. said, hey, I think I'd be a great guest, turns out they're a great guest.
Turns out they are. Yes, we've had some wonderful guests who've contacted us and glad to have them, and we'd love to have you.
We would indeed. Let's put in one more word for our sponsor before we head out, and our sponsor is...
The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible.
Yes, if you go to lariazilber.com, and actually I should mention, on your screen you will not only see that link, lariazilber.com, you'll see a QR code for it as well.
Ah.
So you all know how to use QR codes by now. Mm-hmm. That'll take you right there. I actually have been working with Laria on her website, and I actually got her website, got her landing page just rejiggered recently. So take a look at lariazilber.com and you will see a wonderful, I think a very enticing description of her book.
Yeah, and we should mention it's available not only in paperback but Kindle, and you mentioned earlier the audio version. So
that Judy did the narration for mm-hmm. with her beautiful voice.
Thank you.
And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.